Welcome to the Healthy Skin Show with Jennifer Fugo, where we're flipping everything you've been told about your chronic skin issues upside down and connecting you with alternative solutions your dermatologist never told you about.
Welcome back to episode number 327 of the Healthy Skin Show. In today's episode, we are diving into IgE food allergies. And when I say food allergies, friends, I'm not talking about food intolerances nor food sensitivities. We are talking about legitimate food allergies, the type that can potentially, in some individuals, lead to anaphylaxis. My guest today is actually a close friend and colleague of Dr. Peter Leo. I think you are absolutely going to love her just as much as we all love Dr. Leo. Her name is Dr. Ruchi Gupta, and she's a professor of pediatrics and medicine at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and a clinical attending at Ann and Robert H. Lowry Children's Hospital of Chicago. With over 20 years of experience as a board-certified pediatrician and health researcher, she currently serves as the founding director of the Center for Food Allergy and Asthma Research. Dr. Gupta is world-renowned for her research on the epidemiology, economic impact, prevention, and management of allergic conditions, and strives to find answers and shape policies surrounding these conditions in order to reduce burden and improve health equity. And believe me, friends, my guest today does an amazing job at explaining this complex topic because she herself has someone close to her in her life who has dealt, or well, is still dealing with actual food allergies. So she not only understands this as a professor, as a doctor, as a pediatrician, but also as a mom. So without further ado, let's dive into today's conversation. Dr. Gupta, I am so excited to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, I do have to tell everyone that you are a very close friend and colleague of Dr. Peter Leo, who is a Healthy Skin Show fan favorite guest. So I know that our audience will love listening to you. I'm so grateful that we got to meet this past summer. Yeah. Actually, this past fall. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Everything blurred. It was September, October. But I am really honored to have you here because I've not dove into this, what is, I would say, a pretty serious topic about food allergies, especially when they can become life-threatening for individuals. And I feel like because you have personal experience, perhaps this topic, not that it means more to you, but I think you can relate to your patients and the people out there dealing with this more. So do you want to share why you're so passionate about food allergies?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And yes, I did want to say Peter Leo is incredible, and I'm glad he totally should be a fan favorite, and I will do my best to live up. But yes, my own personal story is quite interesting because I started studying food allergies, and within a couple of years of starting to learn it, my daughter was diagnosed with food allergies. My son was eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, playing with her. She was one. Probably got some in her mouth, and she broke out in hives and threw up. And all of a sudden, you know, I became a mother of a child with food allergies, and I'm part of this amazing community. And so that was the initial story. And now she's 17. So we've kind of gone through all the stages, you know, that really scary early stage of what is this, and how do we deal with this? Because food is a part of everything we do all day long. And how do you keep your child safe or yourself safe every single meal? So, you know, we've gone through the school and, you know, when they're not independent to when they start becoming independent to now in high school when they're super independent, you know, and then going off to college next year, you know, and trying to pick a college because they're going to be completely on their own making their decisions. So that's why it is very personal to me.
Yeah. So in terms of the prevalence of food allergies, yes. I think in general, we have seen this alarming trend, yes. Especially in kids, but there are also adults that can develop food allergies. Can you talk a little bit about that trend? What's the prevalence of food allergies in children and even in adults, if you have stats on that?
Oh, of course. I mean, this is what our research lab does. And so we, you know, 20 years ago when I started, we didn't have those numbers. And so one of the first studies we did was to better understand the prevalence of food allergy, the public health impact in the U.S. And what we know now is that about 8% of kids have food allergy. Now, that's about 1 in 13 or 2 in every classroom. So it's a lot. And kind of to your point, it has become an epidemic. Like, we didn't see this. And what you'll hear a lot is, when I was young, you know, we didn't have this. And when I went to school, everyone took PB&J to school, you know? And so what happened in a generation? So for kids, 8%. Let's talk a little bit about what are those allergens. And so we have what we call a top nine. And some of the ones that everybody knows, peanuts and, you know, all the tree nuts, shellfish and finfish, milk, egg, soy, wheat, and sesame is starting to really ramp up. And we're seeing it as an up-and-coming allergen. Now, you can be allergic to anything, but those are the most common. In adults, what you asked is, it's also, you know, surprisingly prevalent. When we conducted our first adult study just a couple of years ago, it was because we've been talking about kids so much and we think about kids. But when we asked adults, do you have a food allergy? Interestingly, 1 in 5 said yes. 20%. Yes. I mean, it was shocking. When we cleaned it, what we realized was about 10% truly had symptoms of a food allergy, but 10% is a lot too. But the problem in adults, and I do the same, we don't take as good care of ourselves as we do our kids. And so, you know, only 1 in 20 adults were going to see a doctor. So they're not getting it diagnosed. Even the ones with true symptoms, they would eat the food, have a reaction, and then avoid it, right? Thinking they had a food allergy. So this was one of the areas of misconception that we were, you know, trying to help people understand. But the answer to your question is about 1 in 10 adults seem to have a true food allergy.
Gosh.
And they're, the top nine are the same, but the number one allergen in adults is shellfish. Almost 3% of U.S. adults have a shellfish allergy. And then it's milk, peanut, and then the rest that I mentioned. The other interesting thing about adults, and then I'll let you ask me the next question, but the other really interesting thing is about 50% of adults who had a convincing food allergy said they developed a new onset food allergy as an adult. So, you know, we often think this is a childhood thing and then you grow up and some kids grow out of it and some kids continue it into adulthood. But what we were finding are new onset allergies in adulthood, 50%. So a lot of adults, you know, listening, if you have developed, you know, a new food allergy, you are not alone.
No, it is quite, as you say, I know actually a number of people who have developed allergy, like all of a sudden, will eat like something with shrimp and yes, they'll end up, the mouth starts swelling and they're, you know, having their, they're feeling like the throat is getting tight and whatnot. But I do want to clarify things for listeners, because I think this is important. As you know, a lot of people use that term food allergy, but unfortunately, some people really mean a food sensitivity or a food intolerance. So we're using and mixing up these terms inappropriately, which I think at times dilutes the concern and care that potentially someone, say in the food service industry or maybe at a school, right? Because your daughter's going to go to college, might not necessarily, if they're not educated on it, might not understand the severity of a true food allergy. So from an immune system standpoint, what is going on with a true food allergy compared to these other issues?
That is a great question and so important. So, from an immune standpoint, a true food allergy is an immune-mediated reaction. You know, so an IgE, immune-mediated reaction that happens in your body. And what is happening is your body is seeing that food as an invader. And we can talk about how that happens in a bit. But your body sees this food as an invader and goes on attack. So it releases all kinds of chemicals, you know, things like histamine, and really just goes full attack on on this invader they're seeing. Now, how that's different from a food intolerance, which is also very common, lactose intolerance, everybody knows about, you know, and gluten sensitivity. And we hear these terms now. What's happening there is you are missing an enzyme in your gut to be able to convert, you know, lactose, lactase, you know, that type of thing. And so what happens there is you usually get symptoms, but they're usually gut symptoms. So you'll have like cramping and bloating, diarrhea, sometimes vomiting, you know, so very specific symptoms, lethargy, you know, people talk about feeling tired after they eat gluten. So those symptoms are very, very different than a food allergy, because when your immune system reacts, you can have a reaction in any organ system. So a lot of times we talk about skin, hives, swelling, itching, but you can get throat closing, you can get trouble breathing, chest tightness, you can get the GI symptoms, vomiting being one of the most common, drop in blood pressure. Your body takes over and is attacking, and it can go into what we call anaphylaxis, which is a very severe reaction that happens rapidly and can lead to death, even though it is very rare. I want to put that out there because people get very fearful, but this cascade can be really severe.
And the one thing I also learned from you in the presentation you gave is that it may not be immediate. Like I think if someone ate something and maybe 10 minutes later, or not even that long, they'll start experiencing these symptoms. So is it possible that there could be this delay of onset of anaphylaxis for somebody who might actually be initiating this type of immune response?
Yes. So if in a true food allergy, once you eat the food, the most common is that they will start having a reaction. A lot of times right when they put it on their tongue, they'll feel it. You know, they'll feel something's wrong and some tingling, and they'll start feeling it in their mouth. The progression of that, so we usually say within the first 2 hours, you usually have symptoms. But the majority of times it's in that first 30 minutes, you know, and very rapid. The problem is sometimes it'll be mild. If they only had a tiny bit or, you know, didn't have a big exposure, caught it and have a reaction, it may be hives, just a couple of hives, or they vomit once and they're feeling better. Or it can expand and go into different organ systems. So I think that's why food allergy is so confusing, is you can have a rapid onset, you can have it, you know, potentially after an hour. And then the other thing is, once you do have that reaction, a subset, 10 to 20%, can have a secondary reaction hours later, and it can come back. So that's where I think food allergies become so complicated. But I think the most important thing for people who are listening is just, you know, watch those symptoms, because if they are multi-organ, it is really, really important. Or if you feel like they're getting worse fast, it is really, really important to get that epinephrine auto-injector and get it in your system, because that will help stop it the fastest.
Yeah. And it sounds to me like from what you're saying is that if you believe that you may be having this type of reaction, it's best to not be alone.
Yes.
Like, don't go home on your own. It sounds like it's better to be around someone else who could possibly check in with how you're doing.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness. If you feel like you're having a reaction and you're alone, please tell people around you, you know, and get support. Don't, you know, be worried about it and do it on your own. But know how to use an epinephrine auto injector on your own, you know, for yourself, because giving that to yourself is really important. And then if you're still, you know, feeling symptoms, you need to get medical attention. So yes, absolutely. Notify people around you.
Yeah. And so I will also share, I actually shared this on my Instagram when I was attending the Food Allergy Research Allergy Summit. And yeah. I realized that regardless of my training, I admittedly don't have somebody directly connected to me in my life who has food allergies. I don't have food allergies, that a lot of the information that I came into the conference thinking was correct was really actually quite outdated and not correct about food allergies. So it was extremely sobering to me to realize that I don't know about as much about this as I should, but also just from, like, it's my hope that if people listen to this, even if they are in the same boat as me, that perhaps they will help. You know, you never know. You might be the person who identifies or recognizes, like you said, somebody potentially going into an allergic reaction, and you at least know what to do. So with that being said, one thing you shared is that Benadryl is actually not that helpful, which I thought, I always keep Benadryl in my medicine cabinet thinking if somebody starts to go into having allergic reaction because of food, I have Benadryl. And that is not quite true. So what do we need to know about that?
Yeah, well, but you're not alone. And the reason is because so much has changed in our understanding of food allergy in the past 20 years. I mean, when I got into this, same, Benadryl was kind of the go-to for a reaction. Then what we started seeing is that if you only give Benadryl, it may mask some of the symptoms because it takes away maybe some of the rash, you know, and some of the itching, but though the reaction continues to happen in your body. So slowly, as we started seeing more people have these severe reactions and being given Benadryl and not getting better, you know, and then not observing it, the whole field kind of changed their stance. So what you heard is kind of what people thought. But now what we say is don't give Benadryl unless it's a very, very mild reaction. Like if they touch something and they get a couple hives on their hands or something like that. If observe the person having the reaction, and if it is getting more and more severe, or if they are feeling it, because you know, as an individual, I've seen my daughter, she knows, you know, this is bad, or this is really something that's going to expand, just give the epinephrine. And epinephrine auto-injector, so, you know, before we only had one. We're very fortunate now to have multiple types. So, you know, we still have the EpiPen. There's the AviQ, which talks to you and tells you what to do. There's generics now that you can get. And exciting news, on the horizon, there is a sublingual, and there are two different groups making a nasal epinephrine. So hopefully in the next year, you'll have other delivery methods. But get that epinephrine into them as soon as possible, because it will stop it. And epinephrine is so safe. People fear it, but it's your own adrenaline. You know, in Europe and other countries, they call it adrenaline. It's what you have in your own body, you know, which is also working to help relieve you, but this just helps it go faster.
Yeah. And the other question I did want to ask around this was about Zyrtec, because you mentioned Zyrtec and how that might be perhaps better than Benadryl. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So Zyrtec and Benadryl, I mean, they all are antihistamines, you know, Benadryl's diphenhydramine, Zyrtec and Allegra and Claritin, you know, those are three very common antihistamines. The thought is they're all pretty similar, but Benadryl is sedating. Right? It makes you sleepy.
That's okay.
And these others are not, you know? So sometimes a lot of allergists have switched to advising to go with one of the non-sedating ones, because what we would see with Benadryl is then if it's a child, they would get sleepy and fall asleep, and then you don't know, you know, if they're continuing to have a reaction or not. So that was the reason. But all of those do the same thing. It's just one makes you sleepy.
Yes. And again, this is just like so fascinating because, as you said, things have changed. I'm going off of information. I'm in my 40s. So like you said, when I went to school, there were very few food allergies, and that's what you were told. Oh, Benadryl, you have a problem, take Benadryl. And now that's not quite the case. Right. And one other surprising thing that I did want, and I think is important to share about, was that I didn't realize it was this real big fear of using an EpiPen. Like a lot of, I was really taken back at the number of people in all of these different talks who were so apprehensive of having to inject themselves or a loved one injecting them. Yeah. What do you find is the main driver of this fear?
Yes. Shots. People don't like needles. Yeah. And I think that really scares people. And the idea of giving yourself a shot or putting a needle in you is, I think, what brings up a lot of that fear. The other thing is, you know, right now, if you give epinephrine, we say then you have to go to the emergency room. And that's also challenging for a lot of people to do. So it almost makes it sound like, oh no, this is going to be a big, severe whole day episode, you know, that I'm going to have to deal with. So, but I think the needle fear is often one of the big ones. It's going to hurt, or I've never given anyone a shot, or, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, what we've seen is once you do it, the fear really goes away because it doesn't hurt. And it actually makes you feel better. You know, like the needle's really tiny and it goes in and medicine's in within a second and they start feeling better right away. So you'll hear stories from people who have used it, who are now very, very comfortable using it. So I think it's getting over that first fear of using it. And then after that, people who've had multiple episodes are very comfortable. So encourage people not to let that stop them. But in another year, hopefully they'll have other methods and other ways of using it. Yeah. And the other thing I would say is do not use it because of the emergency room. I'd rather people use it and then, you know, call their doctor or, you know, watch than delay it because of having to go to the emergency room. So the sooner you use it, you know, the better the outcome.
Yeah. And you work in a research lab, which is so cool. So you're in this all day long. Yes. Is there anything that could help listeners understand why people are developing these types of reactions to certain foods?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest questions we get asked is why, you know, why are we seeing such high amounts? And we know it's everything's genetic environment, but genetics don't change that fast. So what is it in our environment? A lot of things that we talk about in the environment, you know, are around now this whole microbiome idea, you know, so originally we said too clean, but being too clean is influencing your microbiome, right? So your microbiome, I think most of your listeners probably know what that is now, but it's all these bacteria and viruses and fungi that are in our gut, but they're on our skin and they're, you know, all over us. And they have a big part to play in our health. Yeah. And so if we disrupt that microbiome in certain ways, we think it may be leading to things like food allergies. So some examples that people talk about a lot are, you know, how things have changed in our environment. You know, we have more antibiotics early in life, in, you know, maternal antibiotics, and then to infants in that first year of life. We have more C-sections where the baby's not going through and getting mother's bacteria. The way we eat has changed, right? Like a lot of the people that talk about the processed foods and potentially pesticides and all the things that may go into our body and disrupt our microbiome. Another big thing is just medicalizing infant feeding. So a really big study, a big finding was looking at, you know, when in the year 2000, when we started seeing higher rates of food allergy, the American Academy of Pediatrics said, oh no, you know, there's something going on here. Let's advise not to eat peanut products till babies are 3 years old. Okay. So peanut, egg, let's wait. And so, what happened is we pediatricians like myself who were training around that time started telling people not to introduce. Then in 2008, there was no data showing that that was true or false. So they took it away, but pediatricians still kept saying, don't introduce. Then, in 2015, the LEAP study was published out of London, which showed that actually introducing peanuts early may prevent peanut allergy because your gut, your body, when you're an infant, your immune system is being introduced to that food. So then guidelines changed immediately. And so now we have ways to potentially prevent food allergy. But, you know, getting from your why to what have we done in society, you know, by delaying it, Did that actually increase how many people, you know, in our, in the US are developing these foods? So multiple reasons, probably not just one.
No. And I know Dr. Leo has spoken, I don't know if he's discussed it here on the Healthy Skin Show, but he also talked about with babies specifically becoming sensitized possibly. So can you just touch on that? Like it might not be from eating the food. It could be from applying or coming in contact with the food on your skin.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for bringing that up, because one of the biggest hypotheses right now is if a food is introduced through your skin before your gut, then your immune system goes on the attack, right? So if that peanut protein, and I know I'm guilty of this, and I know mom guilt is very prevalent, but when I, you know, had my daughter, you'll be nursing and you'll be eating healthy nuts, right? You think that's a very healthy snack. But that protein may be falling on their eczematous skin. She had severe eczema. And then the immune system sees it before your gut sees it and thinks it's an invader and goes on attack and switches your immune system to this pathway, this food allergy TH2 pathway instead of the normal pathway. So the idea was, if we can get it into the gut first before, you know, it comes in contact with eczematous skin, then maybe we can protect them and get them on the right immune pathway. The other thing that Peter probably talked about is that's why it's so important, if your infant has eczema, like mine did, severe eczema, to get to your pediatrician, get to a dermatologist, and really take care of it. Because what we're hoping is, by protecting that skin barrier, those proteins will not be able to get in and be recognized as an invader. So definitely protect that skin barrier.
Yeah. And that sounds like, I was going to ask you if you have any thoughts on things for parents to do to possibly help their kids avoid developing allergies. This sounds like one of those things. Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts or tips that could be helpful for parents?
Absolutely. I mean, we're learning so much about prevention. So first, if they have severe eczema, if your baby does, get to your pediatrician and start talking about it. Get to an allergist, get to a dermatologist. The earlier, the better. Second, introduce like peanut products early to your infant. So now we're talking like they are ready to eat usually around 4 to 6 months, you know, so when they're ready to eat, you know, one of the, you know, don't start with it, but one of the early foods should be peanut products. And then we're doing a large study in our center looking at the 8 foods, the 8 most common foods. So we're looking at, you know, milk and egg, peanut, tree nuts, and getting them into babies and seeing if we can prevent multiple food allergies. But the recommendation right now is just feed your baby. I think we've medicalized feeding too much. You know, waiting 3 to 5 days doesn't make sense, because you're going to get so little food in your baby early. You know, wait a day. If they're going to have a reaction, it's not going to take 3 days, you know, to see it. And so get high diversity of foods into your baby early. So don't worry about this whole medicalization we've done. Yeah. And then, yes, introduce those foods, protect the skin. I would say those are the two biggest things.
Awesome. Well, I did want to touch on the fact that you also have this really beautiful product called Yobi. I feel like we have to do like this whole other conversation on the scalp microbiome because of your research. This product exists, which, do you just want to talk a little bit about that? And everybody can go and find that. We'll put a link in the show notes, but it's yobicare.com is where you can find the product. So what is Yobi for?
Yes, thank you. So again, you know, a lot of these stories are personal, but my daughter was born with terrible cradle cap, which I'm sure people can relate to listening, and severe eczema, which I mentioned. And back then, there was very little we could do, and still there's not a lot. It's steroids is a big part of it. And it's terrible. And I'm sure on your show, you've talked about it, how hard it is for parents, itching all the time, uncomfortable. So as a pediatrician and a researcher, I just kind of went to work. She became my guinea pig, and we tried a lot of stuff. And we found a group of ingredients that worked really well. It was probiotics. So probiotics mixed with honey and turmeric and vitamin B12. And Peter Leo helped come up with this recipe. But we tried it on her. And when we tried this, her cradle cap went away. It was, wow. It was gone. And it worked so well that I started giving it away in my Pete's clinic. And we gave it to everyone who came in, and we had really good success over 10 years. And so Now, 10 years later, we want to share it with the world. And what we found in those 10 years is not only did it work for babies, works great on kids, it works great on adults, because what it's doing is helping to balance your scalp microbiome. So we have it. It's yummy. Yes. It's a jar. It's really, it's like a thick solution. You mix it with a little bit of water, add it to your scalp, massage it in. We have a scalp massager. You can use massage it in. It's really, really helpful. It wakes up your scalp. And then because people really like shampooing and conditioning, they asked if we could make some natural shampoo conditioner. So we did that as well. And then a lot of people apply it to their skin. So we came out with the skin cream, and all of them have those four ingredients, probiome. And it's just a healthy way to keep your scalp and skin microbiome balanced. So yeah, try it. Give me feedback. I'd love to hear, but works really great for dry scalp dandruff, but works for all scalp types.
Awesome. And before we wrap up, I do need to share with everybody, you have an amazing book, by the way. It's called Food Without Fear. It is available everywhere. And it's a great resource for parents, adults, whomever, to better understand how you said you wrote this during COVID. And you know, this is a great resource for people who are wanting to learn more about the food allergy topic and to better understand how to navigate this space, because there's a lot of overwhelm. There's a lot of confusion. I will say, being within that community and getting to hear the anxiety, the stress levels, the confusion, it was touching to me to see the advocacy that is going into trying to help this community, because it's not to put down other skin conditions, but this can be life-threatening. And so I can understand the fear that just to be able to eat, right? Just to be able, for some, even just to be in the same room with something can be really scary and overwhelming. So it's an excellent book. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. And then you did share with me as well that if someone is in the Chicago area and they're looking for a trained allergist who is a part of this Northwestern system, because you're in the research lab and you do see some patients, but they might not be able to get to you specifically, but some of your colleagues, can you just talk a little bit about what CFAR is?
Yeah, CFAR is the Center for Food Allergy and Asthma Research. And, you know, one of our big areas outside of research is helping the community. So please, it's cfar.northwestern.edu. Write us. We would love to help you find good care. And in Chicagoland, but we do know people all over the country. So I don't want to limit it. I get requests for every state out there, and we will help support you, because getting good care is the first step. And that's also part of the book, because so few people get diagnosed. One of the reasons we wrote that is it really explains all types of conditions. And like you said, I mean, we talk about skin in there and how important it is, because a lot of these conditions are related. You know, oral allergy syndrome, what do I have? You know, when you're like, what is this? And it'll help you figure it out. And that was the goal. And then you can go to your doctor and say, look, I really do think it falls into this category, because there's GI conditions, you know, there's intolerances like we talked about. And then there's immune mediated conditions. There's other things like eosinophilic esophagitis and FPIs, a lot of things that are coming up that are related. So kind of go through all of that investigation in the book. So, and yes, please, I really love it. I am part of this community, and anything I can do to help support your listeners, I would love to.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Gupta, for being here. And it sounds like we have a lot more to discuss. So I hope that you will be back. And I will definitely make sure to put all of the links of everything we discussed in the show notes to make it really easy for listeners to be able to find you and connect with other professionals who can really help them, because your Yobi and your book. I mean, there's so much stuff that you have for the community. It's wonderful. So I appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you so much, Jennifer. I'm very honored to be here.
This topic about food allergies is so crucial to the conversation, especially as we are watching food allergy diagnoses rise, not only in children, but also in adults. And so I'm glad that I was able to connect with Dr. Gupta and have her come here. I promise you, she will be back. So I would love to hear more about your experience with food allergies, especially if this is something that you are dealing with in your life, whether it's supporting a loved one going through this, or you yourself have been living with a food allergy. I would love to learn more about your experience and the questions you have as we continue to unpack this complex topic around food allergies. So if you want to check out the resources that I've linked up for you in this episode, or you'd love to share your thoughts, head on over to skinterrupt.com/327, and there we can keep the conversation going. Then I invite you to share this episode with someone you know who may have questions about food allergies, or maybe at the beginning of their journey dealing with food allergies, because I believe that this interview could be extremely valuable to them. And if you've been tuning into the Healthy Skin Show for some time, I would deeply appreciate it if you would rate and review the Healthy Skin Show on the podcast platform that you are tuning in on, and then make sure to hit that subscribe button. That way you never miss a weekly dose of new research, inspiring stories, and alternative strategies to help you on your journey to rebuilding healthy skin. And then let's connect online. I'm at Jennifer Fugo. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I look forward to diving deeper with you in the next episode.